So we've made an investment in a developer, a company called Canon Energy. And I think the typical, if you typically ask VCs, they'll say, oh, it's just a developer. We don't want to invest in a developer. We want to invest in a company that's building hardware in this space. And so a lot of hardware companies are able to raise money. Well, every single hardware company that makes some form of hardware is going to then go on to become a developer. They're going to try to figure out how to build projects, work with customers, et cetera. So they need to do everything that Canon Energy needs to do. In addition to hiring a tremendous number of engineers to build their technologies, scale it up, et cetera. And so when we look at Canon, Canon is in the process of deploying don't want to out them on the scale, but a couple of projects in the nine figures right now. And the company has raised the seed round. Because they're using off-the-shelf technology, they understand how project finance works, and they're inherently built for that ecosystem. And then when we look back at the history of developers, there's a lot of developers that have produced wonderful outcomes that we'd be excited to have in our portfolio.
Welcome back to the Clean Techies Podcast, where we interview the top founders and VCs in climate. In this episode, I sit down with Mike Jackson, managing partner at Earthshot Ventures. Earthshot Ventures call themselves carbon generalists and invest from seed to series B. They mainly invest in software and quote-unquote step change hardware with a preference to double down on their existing portfolio companies. Mike's story is great because of how intentional he has been in excelling at every stage of his career on multiple sides of building and climate. He is a successful founder from Cleantech 1.0, a rockstar investor even before Earthshot, experience in project finance, and now investing in a collaborative way that is pushing the whole climate tech industry forward. In this episode, we talk about Mike's journey from donating his allowance to environmental groups to a career in climate VC, what he's learned from building in Cleantech 1.0, why he's shifting earlier with his investing, what he's looking out for with regards to AI, strategies for startups to get project finance, business models that drive success in climate tech, what he's learned from coaching hundreds of startups on fundraising, and more. As always, thanks so much for listening and enjoy the episode. All right, Mike, welcome to the show. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks for having me here.
I'm super, super excited for this. As the audience knows, I shout this out almost every episode, but I work at Elemental Accelerator, focusing on the built environment. And so having Mike here, who is, as I'll tell you, the managing partner of Earthshot Ventures, which is basically a sort of a partner in crime, this is an amazing opportunity. So thanks so much for being here, Mike.
Really excited to be here, yeah, and excited to continue that connectivity between Elemental and Earthshot.
Yeah, so not to keep the audience in suspense, please tell us, who are you and what do you do?
So Michael Jackson, and I'm a venture capitalist at a firm called Earthshot Ventures, so an early stage venture in the climate ecosystem.
Yeah, so I think that's greatly simplifying all of the cool things that you guys do. But before that, I'd love to talk a little bit more about you. Can you tell me about your journey going from, and I've thankfully been able to listen to this before, so I have a lot of really cool context on it, but please tell me about your journey going from college to now leading a very well-regarded climate fund.
Sure. So I did an undergrad and master's at Stanford, was there at a time when energy was just starting to emerge as a sector for folks to focus on in college. Got an undergrad degree in a degree called Earth Systems and Biology, and then did a master's degree in energy engineering. I then left there and ended up starting a company in the carbon offset market, the very, very early days of that market in the mid-2000s. Started with a buddy from undergrad, and we were able to find a bunch of customers, self-funded though, didn't go through the venture capital route. And then when the financial crisis of 2008 hit, became clear that it would be nice to have that sort of nest egg of cash sitting around. But at that time, I then got connected to the folks at the Wesley Group who were in the process of raising their first fund. That was a fund raised in the sort of first wave of clean tech in Silicon Valley. We raised $125 million first fund, joined them originally as an intern, and then got a full-time job a couple of months later. And then stayed through two full fund cycles. So stayed from investing our entire first fund. That was much more heavy industry in and around the clean tech ecosystem. And then we were able to raise a second fund in 2012, 2013 timeframe, way more software-oriented investments, much more in the realm of kind of business model innovation in the climate ecosystem. And to me, that was just a really interesting juxtaposition between the two and a really wonderful learning experience, which I think we brought forward into a lot of the insights of what have driven Earthshot. After being at the Wesley Group for 9 years, I ended up joining a firm called Generate Capital. Generate's a project financier in the climate ecosystem, and there got to look at a lot of the assets that were going to be what's next for Generate. So things that were still a little too risky emerging out of venture capital, but we're beginning to think about that non-dilutive funding. And my role was to meet those companies, build that interface between Generate and those early stage companies. Wonderful experience, learned so much about how that type of money works. Wish I had known that in 2009 when I first started at the Wesley Group. And then started to work with Elemental Accelerator, and there coached a number of Elemental's portfolio companies through seed rounds, through Series C, helped some companies raise project finance, and just helped them think about being kind of like the VC on their team as they went through that process. And then through those efforts, Don and I ended up deciding to spin out and create this venture fund, which we called Earthshot Ventures, which we began talking about in 2020 and did our first close in 2021, and have been investing out of that fund ever since.
And so to recap for the audience, especially, it's hard to keep track of everything that all the cool things you did. Rockstar, veteran of Cleantech 1.0, went through multiple cycles as you're being humble and not mentioning this, but a really stellar track record at the Wesley Group, then moved into project finance and got that experience, moved into the venture space from a coaching perspective, and now leading your own fund, looking to invest in the best, essentially. Amazing, really amazing stuff. I had the opportunity to listen to your interview on VSC Ventures with Vijay. We've actually had Jay Kapoor on the show, and it was phenomenal. So love their work. And I remember you mentioning that your first interest in the space was actually when you donated your allowance to a number of different causes, and your dad was a big inspiration for you. So I'd love to hear a bit about that. But also, I'm wondering, that was sort of maybe some proximal interest in the space, but when in this journey did you really realize that I'm going to go into this as a career?
Yeah, great question. So for some reason, this has been something that has interested me since I was a very little kid. Always been interested in animals from a very early age. It's now really fun to watch my kids growing up in that era, and a couple of my kids being incredibly interested in the same sorts of issues. Of course, I'm feeding that enthusiasm as best I can. And so when I got to college, I was certainly very interested in the environment, trying to figure out how to turn that into a career. A lot of the perspective was you can become an environmental lawyer. That never exactly appealed to me. And so I continued forward in the process, but tried to figure out where I was going to land. And at some point during college, came across clean energy as this industry that was likely to grow every year I was alive. It was a way to kind of join the business community and to have a real exciting career in this space. So for me, that was an epiphany that flipped maybe sophomore year of college, and I have just stayed stuck on ever since that time. So I haven't really deviated from the sort of for-profit realm around climate since that time. And it's been, I think that original premise was extremely insightful. I think I was right that this industry was going to grow so much. I had the benefit of taking some entrepreneurship classes at Stanford, which was an amazing trial by fire in terms of learning how to write a business plan, learning how do you market your product to customers, how do you hire people, and all the rest of it. All of that was just fascinating experience to get really early on in my trajectory. And I think that blend of the science and engineering with the entrepreneurial experience has made venture capital be a pretty logical place for me to land.
I think that's like a really, really good way of putting it, because it's hard to really understand the tangibleness of a lot of science and climate-based solutions. And I think that's one of the biggest comments that we see on this show, but also anything you read, which is, VC is an asset class built for software, built for high growth. There's questions about how it applies to climate because of the deep tech focus, because of the science focus. And so you see this interchangeability of folks like yourself who actually have that engineering background, being able to actually think about these problems. I'm curious, I'm going to use that as a bad segue into your first experience to talk about with Village Green Energy. Like you said, a company in cleantech 1.0, it was a very early space back then, very different than it is today. One of the really cool things that we'd love to have is I think it's maybe been about like three founders out of the last 10 have all been from cleantech 1.0. And they talk about this decade and a half that they've seen. I'm curious for you, what was it like going from Cleantech 1.0 and building that company then to now, you know, a decade later? How has that experience been for you?
It's been fascinating. It's been interesting to see people come and go in that ecosystem, kind of chasing a fad and then pulling out. It's been interesting to see people really stick around for a long time. One of the things that I think really fascinating now is to watch a lot of the other folks who were peers of mine in that first wave. We were all analysts and associates at various firms in the first wave of climate, and now running firms, the folks at G2BP, the folks at Congruent and Wireframe and others are people I've known for now 15 years. And so it's been fun to kind of watch that generational shift. And at the same time, you have a number of folks who stayed in it and been focused on it the whole time. Steve Wesley, who gave me my first start in this ecosystem, still running a fund, still going strong. The folks at DBL continuing to invest in the space. And so you have this awesome mix now of folks with a lot of experience and now a whole bunch of new folks coming into the ecosystem, folks kind of coming from the tech world into climate, bringing that whole set of experience around team building, around business models that produce big outcomes, et cetera. And that's now intersecting with an investor and entrepreneurial community that now has a lot of experience. Back in 2009, none of us did. And so, you know, we certainly all made a bunch of mistakes and all the rest of it, and we'll certainly make a bunch more of them. But I'm really excited about that combination now of the experience and the kind of hard-earned lessons that have come out of that first wave, and folks kind of taking that to the next level, mixed with that blend of new blood and new ideas into the ecosystem.
We are excited to announce that we have launched a Patreon. You can find this newly linked in our Substack and audio platform descriptions. We are both really just so grateful for each and every one of you, and wanted to create a way to interact with you and for you to support us on our journey as we continue and try to talk to the best people doing amazing things in climate tech. We do all of this on the time we can muster outside of our day jobs, so any support means the world. Now, gushing over, back to the show. For me, hearing stories like that from people who have been able to manifest those relationships over 10, 15 years, like that keeps me going today to talk to as many people, meet as many people, young people, especially the new and younger climate VC associates, and because they will eventually hopefully be some of the entrepreneurs and fund managers of the future. And seeing how those relationships have really benefited you is, you know, hugely inspirational to, I think, a lot of people who are getting into the space now. Kind of going through this transition, I'm curious, what are some of the main lessons that you've learned going from Cleantech 1.0 that made it easier to navigate some of the, you know, consequent, like very turbulent cycles of climate investing?
Sure. So one is around people, as you sort of alluded to. This, we're all in a relatively small pond of folks across the ecosystem, and you're going to intersect with different people repeatedly through your career. And so I remember having a conversation with Scott Jacobs, who's the CEO of Generate Capital, who I've also known for probably close to 15 years, one of the nicest people you will ever meet. And I was sort of teasing him about being such a nice person and successful. And he turned to me and got very serious. And he just said, these are long-lived assets, and it's a relatively small market. Being a jerk is a terrible business model. And I just thought that was a wonderful advice for, frankly, anybody in this space to really think about. So that's one piece. I think a second is really understanding the role of different types of money in this ecosystem. Venture capital is not the only kind of money out there. And I think as somebody who's lived in Silicon Valley for a long time, that tends to be the default positioning from so many people, that if you start a company and raise venture capital money, you're a good company. If you don't do that, you're a bad company. That is a terrible lesson. And my time at Generate, I think, was a really wonderful experience of seeing a different type of money build a wildly successful company. And so that I think is super fascinating. So if you're building a business that is going to need to attract project finance, you have to understand how that money works. You have to build your company from the ground up to be able to access it. And then maybe last one, and we can shift to another direction from here, but is around the thinking about the models and playbooks that have produced big outcomes in other industries historically, and where those might intersect with climate. I think that's what's going to build the biggest companies of this next wave of investment. So looking at models from the general tech ecosystem, looking at models from the traditional energy ecosystem, from biotech, you name it, where those have produced those huge multiple returns, those kind of winner take all dynamics. When that intersects with climate, that's where we get most excited.
The last two points you mentioned, I think, are extremely top of mind for almost anyone who's operating in this investing landscape. So I want to double tap on the project finance side. So you alluded to your time at Generate. When I was listening and reading up some of your materials on project finance, a couple of things really stood out to me. You talked about how founders weren't necessarily always evaluating the quality of the customers they were working with. And that's something that's important to project finance. Another thing is that it's about removing risks and points of failure. So these are all, like you said, maybe not the traditional venture mindset. So I'm curious, what's your take on the most important things that a company can do to prepare for project finance?
Yeah, couple of very quick points. We can dive into any of these over time, but a project financier is going to invest in a project. So it's probably a very obvious data point, but the point of that project is you're gonna set it up as its own vehicle. It's gonna have stuff that comes into the project. You can think of that as your supply. That could be anything from waste materials that might come in. They could be virgin raw materials. It could be sunlight that's coming in. But something is entering that project, and then something is exiting it. And what you want to think about in terms of a project, and what the first set of questions any project financier is going to ask you is, let's talk about your supply. Who's supplying it? Are they supplying 100% of what you need, or a smaller percentage than that? Are they supplying it at a fixed cost or a highly variable cost? Are they supplying it for a long period of time or a short period of time? And is the person who's supplying it to you credible? When you look at that, in many cases, companies don't check that many of those boxes. And ideally, you are checking as many of them as you can, and you get it as close to 25 years from a super high credit quality supplier with a fixed known price. I know exactly what I'm going to pay for it in 18 years from now. And 100% of what I need is contracted there. And then the same set of questions will happen on the customer side. Who's buying what you're producing? Will they buy it for a long period of time at a fixed price? And are they credible enough to do that? The closer that you can get to riskless answers to those questions, the easier you will find it is to get project finance. So that's just very important to think about when you're thinking about the sorts of companies that you might start, especially if they're going to need to raise that kind of money. To think about, okay, if I'm mapping out this idea for a company, is the supply there? Can it check most of those boxes? Is the offtake there? Can it check most of those boxes? If not, are there ways to get creative with it? And that's something that you can innovate on. So Jigar Shah is one of the founders of Generate Capital, and was one of the pioneers of the idea of getting people to sign a long-term offtake to buy the solar power that is produced by their own roof. People didn't used to do that. They typically purchased their utility bills on a monthly basis. But if you could get somebody to sign a long-term PPA to purchase what was produced on their roof for 25 years, all of a sudden, now a financier will come in and say, "Ah, oh, this is a credible person with a high credit score. We've set a fixed price for the electricity that they will buy for a long time. They're signing that long-term contract. I can feel very comfortable putting this here. And the supply is the sun, which is going to be pretty tricky to shut off. All we need to worry about is that tree over there grow too much in the meantime." So those are the types of things to piece together. Then there's some other attributes around the technology itself that we could jump into, around modular technology, just building the technology to be as safe as possible, is the other kind of key part of that overarching bucket. But I think just understanding that framework is incredibly important for entrepreneurs from inception. And I think if that information can be implanted in founders at the very early stages, they can be innovative, they can be creative, they can figure out how to build towards that eventual test.
So for a founder, it's almost like being in control of your unknowns, right? Maybe going from the perspective of a financier, a customer, and understanding the questions they may ask, answering them yourself, and then building assurances against the questions you don't have answers to. Is that, you know, a pretty good understanding of
that? Yeah, I think it's a great way to think about it. Agreed.
And then the second part that you mentioned, like kind of flipping it on its head on the technology side, modular technology, that sounded super exciting because it's been a topic that's come up quite a bit on other, you know, VCs we've spoken to. Modular technologies, I've heard a lot of different approaches from A, you know, being a cost-cutting measure, but also B, being able to fit into these larger hardware systems that can make the cost and overall project seem more like, you know, risk safe. What is your perspective on that?
So there were two types of technologies that got all the money in Cleantech 1.0, solar and cellulosic biofuels. Solar is the ultimate modular technology. The panels are quite small. They're now tens of dollars to purchase a panel. And a solar array is just thousands of those stuck together. So if you want to finance a solar, you know, let's say a utility scale solar system, you can look at hundreds of thousands of systems that have operated. There's no single point of failure. It's an inherently resilient and de-risked system. Contrasted to cellulosic ethanol, where these technologies typically needed to scale up to be a $1 billion plant before you could see if the individual unit worked. And as a result, not very modular, huge amounts of risk. You have to sink a lot of money to be able to get there. And what's happened since that time, we've deployed an enormous amount of solar in the United States and extraordinarily little cellulosic ethanol in that time. So people tend to gravitate towards, oh, if we can build this amazing, huge technology, we can solve our climate problems. I get a lot more skeptical about those types of solutions and instead look for things that are inherently modular and you put hundreds of them together, thousands of them together. Those types of solutions end up being able to attract that non-dilutive funding much earlier in their trajectory. And so for the investors who invest in those, they can then shift to non-dilutive funding. They may still be capital intensive, but they can be effectively capital efficient at the corporate level.
Hey guys, we need your help with something. In order to better understand what you like most about the show, what you dislike, and how we can help you, please take 7 minutes to fill out our listener survey if you haven't already. It only takes about 7 minutes, but it will drastically improve our ability to give you the best content that you're looking for. Thanks for your help. Now back to the show.
That way of looking at it, it reminds me of we had a VC guest, Ben Idelson, from Step Change. And so Step Change is a word that I saw in your investing thesis, specifically about hardware. And I think what you're saying sounds a lot like that approach. So can you tell us a little bit about what a step change in hardware really is?
Sure. So I think we think about when we invest in hardware, seeing those huge step changes in performance. And some of it just comes from the healthy appreciation that building a hardware company is really hard. There's so much that one needs to do. It's so much more complicated in many cases than building a software business. And so you want to have the successful outcome really compensate you for getting there. We've invested, for example, in a company called Lilac Solutions in our fund. Lilac is a company that totally dramatically changes the way that we extract lithium as a society. It enables them to extract lithium from resources that are otherwise, using traditional methods, totally non-commercially viable, and can also increase the yields of existing operations. Totally changes the game around supply of lithium. That's a company where, okay, we're going to take this hardware risk. We're going to take a little bit of scale-up risk. They have some interesting modularity to their technology that got us a lot more comfortable with what they're doing. But success then pays you and compensates you for getting there. I think there's a lot of other companies that just don't have that huge upside. They're selling into a commodity market and they're trying to be cost parity, or they're trying to be a little bit cheaper than the alternative. And those are just really hard to build huge venture scale outcomes in. They're enormously important. It's incredibly important that those companies exist to address climate change in our society. But those are the sorts of companies that I think probably need different types of money. They need to be more risk averse in terms of how they're built to be able to attract that kind of more non-dilutive funding to be able to scale.
Yeah, you don't want to compete on price, right? That just makes a for a more difficult journey. And I think what you're alluding to is also your sense of business models and business values in terms of how to grow. I was told this by your team leading up to this, that you, and I quote, have a good meter for business models. And I think that's really fascinating because it sounds like a portable skill that other people could learn, or at least is not some of this, like, you know, I come from this background with this science, you know, business models are something that people can get creative about. So can you tell us some things that you look for given that sense?
Sure. I would say while we were in the process of putting Earthshot together, I became a big fan of the Acquired podcast. And I think they're a wonderful example of this general concept. So for folks who haven't listened to it, and I would highly recommend it, what Acquired does is they do a deep case study on a number of different companies, and then they kind of shift to what's the playbook here? And how did this company become so wildly successful? They bring in a book that they're both huge fans of called Seven Powers, another book I would highly recommend, which just talks about how businesses can kind of create those monopoly, huge performing financial return types of outcomes and kind of walk through, okay, which of these powers did this particular company have? I think it's a really interesting lens through which to look at companies. We think about it in a similar way. And then we also just generally look for that there are certain types of businesses that consistently have those sorts of powers. When you look across generalist tech, when you look across biotech, when you look across the energy ecosystem, there are models that have repeatedly produced these large outcomes. So we try to find those in this next wave of climate. One example was we did an analysis of the total number of unicorns and said, you know, kind of fundamentally, what's the business model structure here? And about 65% of them were B2B SaaS. It is a model very good at producing large outcomes across a number of industries. It doesn't make sense that it wouldn't do the same in the climate ecosystem. So we love companies that are B2B SaaS companies. Marketplaces are another wonderful example of this. Many of the largest companies in the world are marketplaces. And so where we see marketplaces in the climate ecosystem, we get particularly excited. You also see analogies, though, from the oil and gas space and where that can intersect with climate. One example, when we look at the transportation infrastructure, most of the value in the oil sector accrues upstream. It accrues in the entities that own the resources. So much of the Middle East has been powered by the fact that they own these tremendous resources. Value tends not to accrue downstream at gas stations. Gas stations tend to make their money selling lottery tickets and candy bars. And so as we use that analogy in the electric vehicle space, we've looked for and invested largely upstream. We've invested in Lilac, we've invested in Cobalt Metals, we invest in kind of innovation spaces like Mitrachem, but we've tended to kind of focus on that ecosystem, kind of playing off of the analogies that we've seen in the oil and gas space. So I think just becoming a kind of constant student of business and what has worked and looking for those analogies outside of my otherwise kind of narrow focus in climate, I think that can really help inform and help make us a better investor.
I mean, it's almost like this rapid mental experimentation of business models you're coming across and then applying that to use cases where you think it could actually be useful. And I think the way you've talked about both being in software, which is, I think, like you said, marketplace dynamics, like I think that is a relatively well-known idea, which is how do you port, you know, your typical B2B marketplace into climate. But I think your point to oil and gas is really, really novel. And I haven't heard it much myself. And so do you think that there are types of business models that are given less attention? Because I'm sure the SaaS ones are probably, you know, everyone who's coming from SaaS VC into climate knows about them. So do you think there's any business models that people aren't really looking at that they should be?
Yeah, there's a couple. So we've made an investment in a developer, a company called Canon Energy. And I think the typical, if you typically ask VCs, they'll say, oh, it's just a developer. We don't want to invest in a developer. We want to invest in a company that's building hardware in this space. And so a lot of hardware companies are able to raise money. Well, every single hardware company that makes some form of hardware is going to then go on to become a developer. They're going to try to figure out how to build projects, work with customers, et cetera. So they need to do everything that Canon Energy needs to do. In addition to hiring a tremendous number of engineers to build their technology, scale it up, et cetera. And so when we look at Canon, Canon is in the process of deploying don't want to out them on the scale, but a couple of projects in the nine figures right now. And the company has raised the seed round because they're using off-the-shelf technology. They understand how project finance works. They're inherently built for that ecosystem. And then when we look back at the history of developers, there's a lot of developers that have produced wonderful outcomes that we'd be excited to have in our portfolio. There aren't as many of the companies that build that hardware that then became the developer that scaled. A second that we're intrigued with and haven't placed a bet in, if there's been a number of large outcomes in CPG food, in and across the climate ecosystem. Companies like Seventh Generation, a ton of different food companies, all of those, if you go back to the acquired lessons, have generally the power of brand. And brand has driven them for a long period of time. So the traditional response would be there's no barriers to entry. But just flying in the face of that are companies like Ritz and Oreos, who've been around for over 100 years. They have tons of competitors, but they're enormously durable. And so that's a playbook that we've seen produce a bunch of big outcomes that tends to not get a tremendous amount of attention from venture capital, but an area that we're really interested in trying to find companies in. Tends to be hard to predict who those are going to be. Why did the Ritz cracker take off, whereas the other one didn't? I'm not sure how to predict that from the very early stages, but what are those leading indicators of success that we can see across these different playbooks, which have played out now hundreds and hundreds of times? And can we learn from that and find that where it intersects with the climate ecosystem? I think we could find some pretty interesting opportunities there.
I think what you're saying reminds me a lot of, what works works. And it's almost like the evolution of VC. This reminds me of a story back when Google was starting. Larry and Sergey were competing against Yahoo, and no one thought Google could beat Yahoo. But, the early investors of Google just looked at the search engine and they were like, this is phenomenally better than what we're seeing. And it doesn't matter how you're going to finance it, right? At that point in time, there was no venture capital or it wasn't that much past fair weather semiconductor days. But it didn't matter. You had to look at the technology. If it worked, it worked, and you funded it how you did. So I think what you're saying kind of reminds me a lot of that, and it's really refreshing to see that ethos existing. Because I think one downside of such a prescriptive model like the climate capital stack is that your creativity almost gets regimented. So I think the way that you think about it feels incredibly inspiring to me. I want to get to your time at the Wesley Group because you very modestly didn't mention, I think, a lot of the really cool things you did. So a quick analysis, you went from intern to partner in 5 years. And so as someone in VC, that's incredible. I would love to spend an entire podcast learning from what you did. But just in the quick few moments we have, I want to ask you, what do you think specifically helped you make those progressions?
So I'd say the first thing is work with awesome people. I want to give certainly a shout out to Steve Wesley, to Gary Dillabaugh, to Mike Dorsey. Who are the three partners there who hired me and taught me everything, gave me a ton of responsibility, and gave me the opportunity to move up. That is not normal. In a lot of cases, folks have a different approach to that. And so I would say an enormous amount of credit goes to the two of them to being open-minded and performance-oriented and incredibly supportive. So that would be the first piece. And I would just encourage other folks who are now in their shoes or my shoes now to take a similar approach to folks, and not think about it as this more regimented. You gotta, I don't know the right term for it. I'll skip going that direction. But so that would be one. I would say the second is just always being willing to jump in and take on hard problems. That was something that I had from my entrepreneurial background before I joined the Wesley Group, where it was, okay, we have to figure out how to do everything. We have no company here. We have to stand it up from scratch. And I think I had that natural approach from having been an entrepreneur. So when I came into the Wesley Group, there were things that I saw, oh, we could do a better job with how we run our CRM. We could do a better job with our due diligence process in these couple of different ways. And so it would really kind of take on those responsibility and be proactive rather than waiting for somebody to tell me to do the following thing. And then maybe a last piece would just be to really figure out how you fit in with your colleagues and partners, and being complementarily value add, finding the right team around you, people who are great at what you're not as awesome at, be awesome at things that the rest of your team isn't as strong at. And having that complementarity is just enormously important to building a successful business. So I think there just happened to be a really nice fit there at the Wesley Group, where we were able to complement each other very favorably.
I mean, you went from the position you started at to, you know, partner level and likely a position of a lot of influence in the firm very quickly. Do you think you were able to live in the moment when all of that was happening? Or did you just wake up one day and you're like, wait a minute, like my life is very different than I thought it would be at some point in time, you know?
We were just working hard. And I think we were trying to find amazing companies. We were trying to help the existing portfolio a lot. And I always appreciated it. I always thought it was the most interesting job in the world. I was at some point, somebody said, do you want to go to business school? And my perspective was just, I just want to get my old job back when it was over, and they'll probably hire somebody in the ensuing 2 years. So no, it didn't really seriously cross my mind. It was an amazing experience. And so much of it was learning by doing and getting a long leash from my colleagues to go out and find what I thought were the best companies and be a meritocracy of ideas around what are the best opportunities there. I think that was another really wonderful attribute of the folks there, that we were really seeking the best ideas rather than who had them, who brought them to the table. That's another enormously important part of I think being successful in venture.
You mentioned a long leash just now. What do you think gave your colleagues the confidence to give you that long leash?
I was decent at what I did. And I think just being able to consistently deliver on things. And so I think just that repeat process of, I think we could be doing this better. I'm going to jump in and with everybody's support and collaboration, make this piece better. I like this deal. I'm going to go walk into Steve's office, tell him about it, get his questions around it, give him some ownership of the deal as well, learn from him around what his objections might be around it, walk out of Steve's office, walk into Gary's, do the same with Gary, walk out of Gary's office, talk to Mike. And that highly collaborative process, and we miss some of that now with folks being more remote, et cetera, that helped us find better opportunities, that helped the whole team opine on things. And it taught me a tremendous amount, because I would get a question from one of the folks that I hadn't thought about, or I didn't think that was as important. And just getting those different perspectives was enormously helpful.
Moving to now past that time, you're looking at being, like you mentioned, an investor in residence at Elemental Accelerator, now getting up to probably more closer to the current day. Before you led Earthshot, you were a coach there, specifically to my understanding, helping fundraise. But I'd love to hear a little bit more about that time. What was that like? And what do you think you took from transitioning from Elemental to Earthshot?
Yeah, so I did a lot of this when I was at the Wesley Group in a relatively lighter fashion, because we were working with a smaller number of companies. You have a whole portfolio. You're trying to source opportunities and evaluate the next ones. And there's only so much time that you can spend working with companies. What was awesome about my time at Elemental is it was kind of all I did. I coached companies for a living and put in my, got up the 10,000 hours of working with portfolio CEOs extremely quickly. And so that's been a wonderful experience for me to just have that deep, deep focus working with folks. I think what I learned throughout a lot of that process is it's not rocket science. I was able to just kind of teach people, again, what that test sort of looked like when you were going out to go raise money from folks, having sat at on the other side of the table, switching back to the side of the table of fundraising. It just allowed me to explain, this is what I'm doing as a VC to evaluate you. So how do you help communicate that information to the VC? This is what that person's job looks like. All of that kind of empathy for who is ultimately kind of buying the product was really helpful to instill in the heads of companies. And then some of it is just like explaining to them how the process works. And entrepreneurs are incredibly smart. And if they know how the process works, they're like, I got this. Thank you. I wish I had known that beforehand, but now I can kind of take it from here.
How did that experience then inform what Earthshot became in terms of like your thesis and approach? One thing I want to bring up is one thing I definitely see a parallel between is that you call Earthshot a network fund. And it's not something that I've heard very often, but you mentioned in one of your talks at the New York Stock Exchange floor talk that you have this philosophy of thinking about this fund like a network. And I found that super exciting. And I want to really understand, why do you think that that's successful in the climate space?
Sure. So this is a baby version of a firm that takes this to a high art, which is a group called Village Global. Village Global started by a buddy of mine named Ben Kasnoka. Ben was formerly the chief of staff of Reid Hoffman. Reid Hoffman is a huge believer in the idea that networks are just better than people. And I think it's a very interesting general concept, but networks are going to be better at finding interesting companies. Networks are going to be better at bringing diverse perspectives into evaluating them, both in terms of contrarian viewpoints and depth of viewpoints. And networks are ultimately going to be more helpful at helping those companies. And so I love that concept, and it requires a little bit of a lower ego to be able to get there. But instead of the more traditional venture model of we're the smartest people in the room, we provide the best advice, guidance, et cetera. And so we've tried to lean into that increasingly at Earthshot, figure out ways that we can find interesting companies from more places. We work with Elemental Accelerator, who finds companies across the world and refers opportunities to us. We have a venture partner program where we're working with a number of different folks who have depth in particular areas and are able to bring that into our investment committee meetings and into sourcing and helping our companies. We're in the process of launching a scout fund as a concept to be able to give companies interesting entrepreneurs a small checkbook and say, who would you invest in? A way to again invite those diverse perspectives in. And so all of that is in this spirit of building a constellation of amazing people around the firm, and that general premise will end up building a more successful company. So I think it was kind of baked into the DNA from the beginning through the relationship with Elemental, and it's something that we've continued to build on over time. But I definitely want to give the hat tip to Ben and Reid in terms of their really taking this several steps further.
I mean, to be the co-founder of LinkedIn, it's probably good that he really believes in the power of networks, right? Like, that makes a lot of sense.
Yep, absolutely.
The Scout Fund idea is really cool. We recently had Mike Hall from Anza on, and so his technology, and I think it's emblematic of a lot of technologies out there. There are some technologies where you just aggregate buying behavior, and you can sense the direction, especially with procurement of materials and climate. That information of where things are going is incredibly important. And so being able to do that and then utilize that information, I told him, I was like, you could probably start a fund off of like knowing where the direction of batteries are going, right? So I think that point is really, really like interesting. I want to then move on to touch a little bit about Elemental. I know we're Earthshot, my apologies, and I'm running up on time. About a year ago, you, on that same interview with Vijay on the VSC Ventures podcast, you talked about how you may be investing earlier and earlier based on the macro conditions of the climate economy. Do you still see that trend being the case, and where do you see it going?
Yeah, so we've continued to invest early. Our sweet spot is at the seed stage through Series A. We tend to lead at a seed stage. We tend to follow at Series A. And we have invested earlier than that. We've invested in people with an idea, and we've invested in Series Bs. I continue to think that the early stage is a really exciting time to be or place to be investing in this ecosystem. What we've also started to scale up in terms of our own efforts, we do a lot with data to find interesting companies, and we've started to be able to find founders in stealth mode. We've been able to kind of find folks with who are listed on LinkedIn in that stealth mode posting. And that's allowing us to meet people really, really early on. Also, as we built out these network concepts, we're just connecting with more people earlier on in their trajectory. And so I think getting more exciting opportunities at those early stages. When we first started, we hadn't built out a lot of those sourcing efforts. And it became a little bit easier to say, okay, well, what's kind of coming down the pipeline? What is what's already been funded? And then how can we kind of jump on board with those? But it's been fun to go earlier. I think that's probably my natural comfort zone as well as an investor. Really enjoy getting involved from the ground up. And so it's been fun to kind of lean more into that DNA.
Continuing on, you know, your thesis at Earthshot and the things you're seeing, the last technology trend that you talked about was computer vision and how that's a technology trend that's intersecting climate. What is another technology trend that you see that kind of caught your eye about things you want to look at?
Sure. So it's obviously pretty it's overhyped, overstated, but AI is making some big impacts on climate. We were investors in Cobalt Metals, who's bringing AI into the materials discovery space, trying to find where the precious metals of the sustainable transition will be located. And it's working. They just announced an enormous find recently that they've located, and they have a whole pipeline of other ideas behind that. That's been super cool to see. Mitrachem bringing AI into the materials innovation of designing better. For us, the analogy there came from the biotech ecosystem in terms of how Moderna had built themselves very different from other pharmaceutical companies. Mitra's kind of bringing that playbook into the battery material space. And similarly, it's working. They brought GM into their most recent round and are really ramping up what they're doing. So it's a trend. I know it's something that everybody is generally talking about, but it's something that we just see across our portfolio. And then I think that the other piece to mention here is what we see. Somebody asked me, oh, are you, you know, worried about the kind of runaway risks of AI and climate? And at least right now, no. What we are seeing in climate are technologies that are giving engineers superpowers. So Mitra is able to innovate so much faster. They're able to process through a whole number of ideas. They're able to model in software instead of in hardware. And all of that is enabling them to move so much more quickly, so much more cheaply. There's no risk of a runaway battery, you know, eating the car at some point or something along those lines. And so I'm just really excited about how these trends will continue. And it's just so hard for folks systematically, I think, under anticipate what the impact of exponential growth will look like. And just over the next few years, as AI intersects with a bunch of these companies in climate, some amazing things are going to happen.
Yeah. And that reminds me of like your thesis about, you know, if you're going to do something, do it right. Like, keep it simple. What is the main value add? AI is obviously overhyped, but there are genuine pockets and areas where that amount of compute power and iteration is useful. And I think, you know, we've talked to Sean from Third Sphere about how much AI is changing hardware and hardware iteration. And I think you can see that even in geospatial data. That's a software play where AI really, really helps some of the data gaps that you can see. So there are real applications, and it's great to hear that you as a fund manager are still embracing it despite maybe some of the exaggerations people have gone to. We're coming towards the end of the episode, and we always love to give the founders and VCs who are listening a little bit of insight into, you know, your advice to them. So easy transition here. You brought up Cobalt Metals. They raised their Series A from Andreessen Horowitz and Breakthrough Ventures. And so, you know, tapping and double tapping on your advice as a fundraising expert, they had to pitch two different investors. So how did and do you coach? Two very different ones. So how did and do you coach founders to attract capital from generalist investors in climate?
It's a great question. I mean, the most important thing is to build a great company. And I think investors tend to be fairly smart. If you build an amazing company, investors will find you. And so that's certainly a first piece. And then second, it is knowing your audience. So when the conversation that you would have with the Generate Capital is extremely different than the conversation that you would have with a Breakthrough Energy Ventures, which is extremely different than the conversation that you'll have with Andreessen Horowitz. What we tend to like, though, are companies that can build an idea where each of those investors is looking at it through their own lens. They're being sold kind of through that lens. Hey, this is why AI and the team that we've built up here is super interesting. What we find will solve a major problem in the climate ecosystem. Those are two obviously very different stories, but they're both true, and both sides can kind of come together and say, I love it for these different reasons. We think those companies that have those different perspectives that can align on what the company is doing, those are some of the most interesting companies that are being built.
And on the VC side, maybe a little bit of a subliminal messaging or personal interest here, but if you were looking to enter at a junior position, basically be an intern and get promoted to partner, what are three pieces of advice you'd give to VCs who are entering their climate career today?
Source the best companies. It's something that absolutely you can do at the earliest stages. If you find the next Tesla, if you find the next Cobalt Metals, if you find the next Google, you are going to very quickly move up in your career. So think about sourcing in that context. A little harder as an intern to say I'm going to be an amazing board member. That's a little bit trickier. I was not a very effective board member in my third month at the Wesley Group. So that is one. Another would be to say, go deep, be willing to get really deep and understand things very well. Be willing to ask the hard questions in reference checks. That's something that we emphasize, applaud, call out when the person who's championing a deal at Earthshot comes back and says, I called that reference that wasn't on the list, and it was a terrible reference, and I think we need to kill this opportunity internally. We applaud that, right? It's again that kind of meritocracy of ideas, and so be willing to not just like something initially and really push from there, but instead try to get to the right answer. Continue to build the network. As I mentioned before, so many of the people who are investing in this space now are folks who I've known for 10, 15 years. We've all been helpful and supportive of each other. I've gotten tremendously valuable advice from a number of those folks. I've been able to pass on some of that advice to other folks. And so think about it as this collaborative community, and that will continue to pay dividends for you over time. And then maybe the last is learn how to fundraise. So it's the less glamorous part of entrepreneurship. It's the less glamorous part of venture capital, but it's enormously important. I've been a part of a couple of successful venture fundraisers. I've been a part of now over 100 successful, or probably a couple hundred successful VC fundraisers. And so just learning how to do that, how that whole process works, is an enormously important skill and something to get good at over time. So those would be a couple of kind of key pieces to lean into.
Amazing. Well, Mike, thank you so much for joining us. Before we let you go, where can the audience find you?
Find us on the internet. We're at earthshot.vc.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, and we hope to have you back for a repeat episode pretty soon.
Great. Thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate it.